you'll see a lot of very strong things come out. Attorney General Barr is going to be giving a press conference. I think that I hope I'm going to be able to put this down as one of my great achievements, actually.
The Attorney General appears to be waging a media campaign on behalf of President Trump, the very subject of the investigation at the heart of the Mueller report. Rather than letting the facts of the report speak for themselves.
I'm sure people will cherry pick and try to find something in there. If you can't indict, maybe you'll just try to embarrass and harass.
The Attorney General Barr is not allowing the facts of the Mueller report to speak for themselves.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a joint statement. His indefensible plan to spin the report in a press conference later this morning, hours before he allows the public or Congress to see it, have resulted in a crisis of confidence.
What's happened, you've been watching yourself. I mean, what's happened is unthinkable.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega. Happy to be with you here on The Takeaway. And today's the day when the Department of Justice will release a redacted version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Attorney General William Barr is the man at the center of it all, but he was also at the center of a very similar situation decades ago, caught between a government's desire to withhold documents and broader demands for transparency. So let's go back for a moment to 1989. In 1989, this song was Fly, and the sentiment might have been what Barr was thinking. He was head of the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel under the George H.W. Bush administration, and Congress wanted to get its hands on one of Barr's legal opinions that had to do with regime change in Panama. In 1989, President Bush had made it pretty clear that he wanted General Manuel Noriega out of power.
My argument is with the argument that when I say, you know, I'd like to see Noriega out, that means carte blanche commitment of on my part of American force. I'm not going to do that.
And Congress wanted to see Barr's legal opinion because it was part of Bush's justification for taking out Noriega and bringing him to the U.S. But the opinion itself was secret. Congress and the press only had the title to work with.
Authority of the FBI to override customary or other international law in the course of extraterritorial law enforcement activities.
But the government continued to protect the secrecy of the Barr opinion. Here's President Bush being asked about this at a press conference in October 1989.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know what it is. I'll have to get back to you with the answer to your question. Marlon, I don't know what it is. I've not seen the LA Times report, so I just have to not comment until I do.
But a little over 2 months later, Bush addressed the nation from the Oval Office with this update.
I directed our armed forces to protect the lives of American citizens in Panama and to bring General Noriega to justice in the United States.
The U.S. invasion of Panama left an estimated 1,000 people dead, including 23 U.S. soldiers. General Noriega was in fact brought to the U.S. where he spent the rest of his life in prison. So here to tell us what we can learn from 30 years ago about Bill Barr's handling of the special counsel's report today is Ryan Goodman. Ryan's the editor-in-chief of Just Security and former special counsel to the Department of Defense, and he's been writing about the lessons we can take from 1989.
There was every indication that George H.W. Bush was going to try to abduct the leader of Panama. And the news leaked to the LA Times on the same morning as Black Friday, which it even penetrated the news on that day. And the president was asked about the memo at a press conference that day. And the Secretary of State also had to say some words about the memo that day. It was also remarkable because it was issued in such unusual secrecy. And that's actually the terms that were used by the LA Times. Partly because, lo and behold, the OLC opinion overturned a prior opinion, and the Justice Department had made that prior opinion public.
And what were Barr's reasons at the time for the way he acted on this?
Barr started with a line that's in some ways familiar to what some government officials might do, but it's a similar line that he's adopted now, which is, all of this is confidential. I can't even discuss the content of this opinion. It must remain within the executive branch. But that line very quickly broke apart because Congress decided to hold a hearing, brought in Barr to testify. Very quickly in the congressional hearing, it was made apparent that that was not the case, that the Justice Department had shared several legal opinions with Congress over the 1980s under the Reagan Republican administration. So that was his first attempt at trying to fend off transparency.
And even before George H.W. Bush gave the okay for the invasion of Panama, Congress called Barr to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. They asked to see the full text. What was Barr's response?
So Barr's response was, I will summarize the principal conclusions. I'm not going to give you the full opinion. I'm going to summarize the principal conclusions, the exact same language that he used in his letter when he received the Mueller report. And then he did proceed to provide a written testimony. I would even call it a written report, which was his version of the full underlying OLC opinion. And that's where the problem really enters, because he had guaranteed that he would provide Congress a summary of the principal conclusions. He writes 13 pages of written testimony. And now we know, because the full report was revealed to the public over 3 years later, and by no stretch did he actually include the principal conclusions.
When we look at the actual legal opinion that Barr wrote compared to the summary he provided, outside of the fact that he did not summarize the principal conclusions of that report, what are the key differences? What other omissions were there?
So the major omission was that he, first of all, told Congress that the underlying opinion didn't say anything about international law, that it was a pure analysis of U.S. domestic law. And that's not true. The actual underlying opinion specifically said that the U.N. Charter may not prohibit and does not necessarily apply to the abduction of suspects in foreign countries without the state's consent. And it did. He also told Congress some matters, but he left out something that's gigantic for national security law and practice, which is this idea that the President of the United States, according to the Barr opinion, could violate the UN Charter and that Congress couldn't essentially control that. So that proposition was controversial from the very moment that the actual opinion was released to the public.
We should acknowledge here that these are two very different moments in history, but how is Barr's role different today than it was in 1989?
I think that there are some important differences, and some important differences that we can also have maybe greater faith in this current moment. So one difference is that Barr is under intense scrutiny, and therefore he might behave more appropriately this time. The second difference is that Mueller is in the background. So if Barr does grossly misrepresent their work, Mueller is now being called to testify as of this morning by House Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer.
And they're using the fact that they don't trust his impartiality in order to call him to testify.
That's right. They're invoking a crisis of confidence in the Attorney General. And, you know, I have to say, based on the Attorney General's actions in office, I understand that. So that's why Mueller's kind of the potential check on the Attorney General and also Mueller's team. So already we know from Bill Barr's initial letter, quote-unquote, summarizing the principal conclusions, that the Mueller team was highly dissatisfied with his representation of their work, and then it leaked that they were speaking with people at the Justice Department about that to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and that's the first leak of its kind over the entire history of the Mueller team. They have been incredibly quiet. So I think that's another, maybe even a shot across the bow, which is to say to Barr, if you misrepresent this, if you mishandle this, there's another piece of this, which is whistleblowers, essentially. And I do think that might end up meaning that he does practice more of a good faith attempt in this moment. And then the last piece that's very different from the history of 1989 is that in 1989, the Congress was very slow to subpoena the full underlying opinion. It took them 21 months before they actually issued a subpoena. And here we have the House Judiciary Committee having already authorized the chair to issue a subpoena if he so decides to do so. And I think that's another important dynamic that hangs over Barr's head, and therefore he might make very different calculations this time around.
We recently on the show talked about how the judge's jurisdiction over grand jury testimony could potentially be affected by an ongoing case. Let's talk a little bit about it here. I mean, one of the areas that he plans to redact could be grand jury testimony. Does he have an elastic definition of what that means right now?
Yes. There's a terrific analysis done by former U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid on this particular point. lawyers know that when you say grand jury material, it's an elastic concept. It can be brought out to be very far, and it's a lot of it is under the discretion of the Attorney General in terms of what he considers to be grand jury material, and then it could be quite narrow. And that's one big area that one would need to know about. And, you know, one question I think that must be asked of him is, what was your guidance to those people doing the redactions when you defined for them what you meant by grand jury material?
What are Barr's views on what constitutes criminal obstruction of justice?
So this is reflected in Barr's, and I hate to use such a strong term, but bizarre 19-page memo that he sent to the administration when he was in private practice. It causes many people in the legal academy and legal experts to raise many red flags because it's such an extreme version. It's almost impossible to think that the president could obstruct, because he even thinks that the statute needs to like name the president specifically for it to apply to the president, and that the president has this extraordinary power to do almost anything, like to the point of like, it doesn't matter what the basis is for firing the FBI director, though that one's even debatable. But Barr's theories are well beyond that point. And I should mention, you know, he gave an interview in 2017 to The Hill, and he said in 2017 that Mueller's obstruction investigation was, quote unquote, asinine. So that's in 2017. And he also said that Mueller's investigation risks a political overthrow of the administration. So this is a person who seems to me highly biased, has a bizarre view of obstruction. And that's another important question that we all need to ask and answer today. When the Attorney General Bill Barr looked at the obstruction evidence and determined that it did not amount to a crime, did he employ his view of obstruction because it's such a bizarre view? Now, one thing that might give us a little bit more confidence is apparently, according to Barr, he and Rod Rosenstein came to that conclusion together. So we shall see.
Will Barr be upfront, or will he be expected to be upfront about those views and how he informed the final Mueller report?
He is expected to be upfront because he is committed to appearing before Congress May 1st, May 2nd. And already in the summary, he notes, there's a footnote where he says, none of our analysis of obstruction was affected by a constitutional question. But it's very interesting because it's a different constitutional question. It's the constitutional question about whether or not a sitting president can be indicted. So he's already gone there, right into that space. And then the question for him is, but is any of your analysis informed by other constitutional questions, like your theory of the president's ability to obstruct justice or not?
How do you expect the White House to be preparing their response for what they know so far? The New York Times revealed that President Trump already knows some of what will be made public after briefings from DOJ officials. The president has been very clear that, at least initially, that this is exonerating him.
So I think they've got two different battles on their hands. One is the law and criminal law. And then the other battle is politics and policy. So it might even be the case that it is, in some sense, exonerating, at least on the conspiracy charge with respect to the crime of conspiracy. And it might even be that we find that there's not enough evidence that everybody would agree that there's a clear criminal case of obstruction. But then there might be just a lot of unethical, embarrassing actions by the president in the White House towards this investigation. That's one piece. And then a much bigger piece that I think the country, in a certain sense, has to grapple with is it's not about this bright, shiny object of criminal law. It's about a national security counterintelligence investigation. And was there, in fact, another form of individuals on the Trump campaign acting under the influence or manipulation of Russian operatives? And it doesn't matter whether or not they committed a crime, that's a national security threat.
Ryan Goodman is the editor-in-chief of Just Security and a former special counsel to the Department of Defense. And we're covering the report all day here at the show. More voices throughout the day as we read through and figure out what the report reveals. You're going to want to get our podcast later to hear some deep analysis over at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you're listening to podcasts these days, unredacted or otherwise.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.